This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
Well, welcome to Crail Sea on this hot August morning. As many of you know, my name is Greg Garrett. I am a parishioner at St. David's. I am rarely here because I'm usually out in somebody else's church on Sunday morning, which is both a pleasure and a curse. And so whenever I get the chance to be back in the classroom here or in the pulpit, it's a really lovely experience. And so good to be back with you and to see so many familiar faces. Before we start on the content of this morning, which is a conversation about conversations and a conversation about a conversation I wrote a book about, I wanted to draw your attention to something. Father Chuck asked me to represent St. David's on a committee for this new scholarship that's being offered through the Seminary of the Southwest. And I was super excited to do it because I'll tell you just a tiny bit about Pauli Murray and then we'll move into our content. Pauli Murray was the first African-American priest in the Episcopal Church. She was a civil rights activist, a good friend of Eleanor Roosevelt, arrested and jailed for refusing to ride in the back of the bus in the 1940s. A lawyer, a world traveler, and one of the most amazing people that you could ever find. And to not have encountered her before being on this committee was really kind of troubling to me. This was a woman who did so much and did so many things well that I was startled that we had not run across each other before. But the Pauli Murray Scholarship is an initiative between the Seminary of the Southwest and a number of local parishes to recruit people of color to the Episcopal priesthood. And to follow in Pauli's steps. And so although this is not my skill set, we are in the fundraising phase of the scholarship thing. And so Chuck asked me to talk today and later in the congregation, and you'll be reading about this and looking ahead. But our initial fundraising thing is a gala on Saturday, September 28th. And so if this is an area where you have some passion, I'd love for you to make note of this. We will be supporting this as a church next year, and we've made it a budget item for the next fiscal year. But this year, it looks like the support from St. David's is going to have to come almost entirely from members. And so I'll be supporting this. I'll be at the gala, and I hope that some of you would think about this as well, because it seems like a really important thing as we think about diversity in the church. So I'll just draw your attention to that, September 28th. And if that is something that you're interested in, talk to me more about it, or we'll have more information over the next few weeks. So, here is what Rebecca asked me to talk about today. This is my most recent book. It came out in June, and it is a collection of conversations with Rowan Williams, the past Archbishop of Canterbury, and maybe the world's greatest living theologian. Some of you I know were here in Advent, when we did a little bit of teaching from this book, some spiritual lessons from some of the conversations. And so today what I think we're going to focus on, I want to come back and expand our conversation on spiritual practice, because one of the things that's really interesting about Rowan Williams is that sometimes when people are crazy smart, that side of their brain and their life is developed to the exclusion of other parts. But Rowan is actually one of the most spiritual people that I know, with a really incredibly developed prayer practice and a strong sense of all of the Christian traditions of spirituality that he draws from in his own life and in his teaching. And so I have over and over again, because I was raised in a prayer practice where it was very transactional, you know, sort of like the Coke machine, and you put your dollar in and you got a Diet Coke out. And if you didn't get a Diet Coke out, then there was something wrong with, well, probably with you, not with the machine. I think that's how it worked in my church growing up. And so I've learned a lot from him about prayer and spiritual practice that I want to talk a little bit about this morning. The second thing, and this is an area where he and I connected immediately, the first time that I met him, we started talking about American novelists. And Rowan, in addition to being a theologian, is a poet and a playwright and a great student of literature, which he reads in about 8 different languages. During his sabbatical from his time as Archbishop of Canterbury, he wrote a really well-known book on Dostoevsky. And like me, he has this very real sense that God is often moving in the productions of human beings, in great movies and plays and literature. And so I noticed that in the 7 conversations that we had for the book, we talked about Shakespeare in almost every single one of them. And he is an incredible aficionado of Shakespeare. He's actually written a play about the missing years of Shakespeare's life, taking all the research that he was able to find. And it's a really good play. It's been produced. And tells us a lot about who Shakespeare might have been. And then the third thing is something that's grown out of the conversations I've had about this book on Conversation. I've done about 30 different interviews on the book in the last few months. So radio and newspaper, if newspaper actually still exists. I'm kind of dubious about that. But I take the call anyway. And what people have been more and more interested in, as interested as they might be in some of the subject matter, is just the simple fact that somebody would sit down and have 7 long conversations. Because we live in a culture and an age where, because of our technology, because of the cultural divides in our society, it seems less and less likely that people would actually sit down and have a face-to-face conversation. And they're bemused is maybe a little strong, but they're really interested in this idea about how we have conversation. And it has struck me as one of the really essential things in the life of the church. One of the things that we are called to do in 2 Corinthians is to be agents of reconciliation. That is a mission that God has given to us. And the only way that we can be agents of reconciliation, helping to heal the divides in our culture, is to talk to each other. And more important, to listen to each other. And so some of those lessons about conversation that have grown up over the last few months as I've talked about the book were things that I wanted to bring today as something that might be of use in our community. So those are the things that we'll talk about. And I'm going to go ahead and scroll down to the picture of Rowan because I want you to see him. When we did the Advent teaching, I pulled up a couple of pictures from him and said, probably, if you know him at all, you remember him from William and Kate's wedding. And that is not a, you know, it's not a small thing because, of course, the Archbishop of Canterbury is involved in most of the ceremonial aspects of British life, even though the British people are not particularly religious. And it is also, as we said in December, this incredible office. The Archbishop of Canterbury is at least nominally in charge of 80 million Christians. And I say nominally because, unlike the Pope, the Archbishop of Canterbury has no power to compel. You know, he cannot throw people out of the church. He can't excommunicate people. The Archbishop of Canterbury has to lead the Anglican Communion by logic and by persuasion and by encouraging people to come to the table. And that has become a harder and harder thing over the last 20 years in the Communion, as there have been these cultural divides we were talking about. And so when Rowan was given this job, there were some people who thought, okay, either he's the best person ever to do this, because he's so incredibly smart and spiritual, or he's the worst person to do this because he's so incredibly smart and spiritual. And where people sort of stand on it now, and where he stands on it as he reflects on it, is he says, you know, there were some things that we did really well as we could, and there are some places where I still remain really disappointed in myself and in the work of the communion. And I think that that probably is a fair thing to say for a job like this, where you are basically, as I think we talked about it in the book, herding 80 million cats. So if there is ever a day in which all of them go sort of vaguely in the same direction, that's a victory, right? So I'll tell you a little bit about Rowan and myself and a little bit about the book, and then we'll launch into that first thing, lessons on spiritual practice. As I mentioned, Rowan is an intellectual and a writer, and we developed our friendship through that, not through my being Episcopalian and a member of the Anglican Communion. He read a book that I wrote in, I think, 2007 or 2008, and he sent a letter to my publisher. And this publisher was a Christian publisher, not a part of our tradition, and they didn't recognize his name. And so they called me and they said, "We got this letter for you. We didn't know if you wanted it. It's from this guy in London, lives in a palace, looks like Lambeth Palace." Now, I would think any time somebody sends you a letter from a palace, you would want that letter. But so I just said, is it Rowan Williams? And they said, yes. How did you know? And I was like, really, this should be the last time I ever publish with you. And so the letter that he sent me was a letter about, some of you will remember that I wrote a spiritual autobiography about depression and faith. And he really, really liked it and said that it had sort of taken his mind off the problems of the Anglican Communion. It's a really hard book, which tells you how hard it is to be Archbishop of Canterbury. And invited me to come and see him sometime when I was in England, which I go to England a couple of times a year usually. And so he invited me for tea at Lambeth Palace. And I grew up in Oklahoma, and going to tea at Lambeth Palace was not something that we ever talked about. And so I made really good friends with his personal assistant, who basically, ultimately what she came to say to me was just, come. Everything will be fine. Everything that you're worried about, you know, what to wear and how to act and how to speak, and just come. And I didn't understand what she meant, because, of course, until you've experienced something, you don't know what it's going to be like. I mean, that's the experience of our humanity. People can tell you anything, but until you've done it, it doesn't exist for you. And what happened when I showed up is it turned out that Rowan, despite his always having been the very smartest person in the room, I would say probably the smartest person in the building, maybe the smartest person in the country, is one of the kindest people you will ever meet. And we'll talk more about this when we talk about conversation. But even though he speaks eight languages and could dominate every conversation by the sheer force of his will and intellect, he is a person who listens deeply to other people. And I fell for him like a ton of bricks. I was like, I want you to be my new best friend. And we have that experience sometimes, and you don't get them to be your new best friend. But he and I continued to be in relationship, and we've been friends now for, I think, 12 years. When I was dating my current wife, who at that time was one of my best friends, and I was having this ridiculous romantic comedy moment where I'm like, I think I'm in love with my best friend. In the movies, this is either really good or really bad. He committed to pray with me about this ridiculous thing in my personal life. And in fact, the end of that story is I went to visit him at the other palace, the one at Canterbury Cathedral, and he came to meet me at the train. And we had not talked about Jeannie for months and months, but he remembered that this was the thing that was most on my heart and on my head at this moment. And although he had 80 million other Christians to think about, when he met me at the station, he hugged me, and then the second thing he said was, tell me about Jeannie. So this is a person who is deeply human, as well as a deep, powerful intellect, one of the most thoughtful teachers in the church. And to be in conversation with him is a thrill and a joy. And that's one of the things that I wanted to share in this book. And so very quickly, I'll tell you about the series. This is the second in the In Conversation series from Church Publishing. The first was Barbara Harris and Michael Curry, our presiding bishop, and these two pioneers in the Episcopal Church. The third one, which will be out, I think, in the next year, is Stanley Hauerwas, maybe the great ethicist of our time, and his friend Sam Wells, who is the vicar at St. Martin in the Fields in London. And the idea behind these books is to take two people who are good friends and put them in the same room to talk about the things that they're passionate about. And sometimes those things are theology, and sometimes they're history, and sometimes they're politics, and sometimes it's other things. And we'll talk about some of those things this morning. But the real idea behind this was to show a kind of substantial conversation between people who like to talk to each other as a way of showing how we talk to each other. And I think it's a really great idea. It was a little daunting to follow Barbara Harris and Michael Curry. When our book came out, it was not long after Michael Curry had preached at that last royal wedding and kind of drawn some attention. But I think the publisher thought, well, Rowan Williams can probably hold his own. Greg, I don't know, but Rowan, definitely. So let's start with some thoughts about spiritual practice, because as I said, this is one of the things that I think Rowan understands as well as anyone alive. He reads so widely and knows so much, and he puts so much to work in his own life. And even though he is incredibly busy still, he is the Master of Magdalen College at Cambridge, and probably does more speaking and writing than he did when he was Archbishop, when he had like a staff of people to say no. Rowan is not very good at saying no. He is incredibly grounded. And what I think is that because he has this deep spiritual practice, begins every day with an hour of prayer, there is this very real sense that however the world may rage outside his doors, there is an inner calm. And so that's one of the things that I wanted to draw your attention to first. And some of you will remember that we actually talked about this first thing last fall when we did Advent lessons from Rowan Williams. Because one of the things that I've always had trouble with prayer is that I'm a little ADD. It's hard for me to sit still. There's a great essay by Anne Lamott called Why I Don't Meditate. And those of you who know a little about meditation know there's a concept called monkey mind. And I've got a really bad case of monkey mind. And so what happens is I set out to pray and I don't do very well and I feel guilty about it because now I'm thinking about the bills that need to be paid or that deadline that's looming or, you know, what did I promise Jeannie I was going to do? Okay, there were three things, but now there's four, and since there's four, I've forgotten one of them. And so at the end of that time, I always had this sense that I was a failure, a spiritual failure, because I couldn't remain focused on the task at hand. And I don't know if anybody else want to, okay, cop to that. And so the lesson that we learned from Rowan in December, which was really transformational for me, and that I have tried very hard to incorporate in my life, is largely a lesson about self-forgiveness. But the way that he phrased it is simply this. The two things that we are dealing with here are intention and attention. And one may wander, that being attention. But your intention can remain pure and whole. And so you remember, I actually played him talking about this from our conversation. He said, let's suppose that I'm going to the mailbox to mail a letter. That still actually happens. I did that the other day. I'm going to the mailbox to mail a letter. But along the way to the mailbox, my attention may wander. You know, I may see a dog that needs petting. I may see a flower that needs smelling. I may wander a little bit off the straight path directly to the mailbox, but I am still going to the mailbox. And I need to remember that. My intention is whole, even as my attention may wander. And my intention in my spiritual practice is very simply this. I want to encounter God. I want to know and be known by God. And even if every single moment of this process doesn't seem to be directed toward that, in my heart of hearts, that is what I desire. I thought that is really good advice about prayer, especially for someone like me, like some of you, who get a little distracted by things. And so here's what he said, and I love that. I mean, he is just so British. Whatever you're doing something that takes you somewhere, and something happens. The intention is real. The attention wobbles. Don't be too surprised if that happens. And so what he said that he learned from this was the attention I try to bring to prayer doesn't mean I've got to furrow my brow and concentrate furiously. It means I have to be clear as I begin. This is a time given to God. And that has been a really good set of words for me as I think about my own prayer practice. For most of us, we pray as Anne Lamott prays. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Or help me, help me, help me. And so it tends to be what we call occasional prayer. And one of the things that Rowan's practice reminds me is that both the practice of fixed prayer, which is at the heart of our tradition, and the recognition that you can do that and your attention can wander a little bit. You know, so like I like to get up in the morning and I like to pray and it feels like I'm getting started in a good way. And yet, as I'm sitting there, I'm still thinking, all right, what am I going to wear today? And is Jeannie left yet? Because if she's left yet, I may wear something atrocious. Because I count on her. You know that. Are you wearing that? Comment, men? So intention, not attention, is the first thing from our spiritual practices conversation that I think is important. The second thing is we talked a lot about something that is connected to intention, and that is showing up. Showing up. One of my friends from seminary, my friend Carissa, used to talk about her spiritual director. And a thing that her spiritual director talked a lot about was this being present to God. And one of the things that she remembers him saying is, if you're going to have a relationship with God, you may have to lose a little sleep. And for those of us, for example, with young kids, it's like, where do you find your time to be intentional? For me, early morning is a good time for that. I'm pretty tired at the end of the day. But early morning can be a good time for that. And that intent that we set out, that intent to show up and to be present, is something that can be really vital. But when Rowan talked about it, he also talked about the many ways that God can be present for us when we decide to be present for God. Okay, so I'm going to read a little bit of me talking, which seems a little weird, but it's going to set up Rowan talking. It's like, you know, I don't know, plagiarizing yourself or something. The example that I brought into the conversation was the example of being a writer. And I've been a writer for many years, and I also teach writing at Baylor. And I have students all the time who have this very romantic, capital R, notion of the writer's job is, you know, 3 days a year you'll be inspired to write, and that's your writing life. And what I have always told them is that if you only write when you're inspired, you're not going to have a literary career. You cannot just simply write on the days you're bursting with creativity. And what I said is that has sort of helped me make sense of a prayer life, in which I recognize that I said I'm supposed to do this and be present and make myself present, knowing that some days I'm not going to be knocked off my feet, but knowing also the chances I'm going to make that connection are much greater simply because I'm there. And so Rowan talked about one of the sort of spiritual retreat experiences. Every year in his life, he goes to a monastery off the coast of Wales. Does that sound great? And he says, what I value is not the discipline of the monastic life, but walking the cliff path early in the morning. I can recall walking through the woodlands, and as you know, the insistent rhythm of walking, steady, the steady rhythm of praise and acknowledgement. And you're simply saying, well, there it is. There it is. A way of saying, let God's world be. And then he talks about walking in the rain, which happens quite a lot in Wales. There is absolutely nothing you can do about rain. Nothing at all you can do about it. It happens, you get wet, get used to it. And the feeling of exhilarating helplessness in the face of it all is discovering, yes, I'm a creature. I'm a part of this created system. I can't do anything about it, and that's fine. When you sense that, the rain becomes itself a kind of baptism of grace. Isn't that a nice phrase? And so this idea of being present is also an idea of opening yourself to how God might be speaking in that moment. And, you know, I think of the Old Testament lesson we had a couple of weeks ago on Sunday morning about how God revealed God's self to Elijah. And there was an earthquake, and there was a mighty wind, and then finally there was the still, small voice, as the King James Version translates it. Being present to however God might be moving. And your showing up is an essential part of that. And then the last thing that I think also kind of grows out of this, and you see this sort of incremental thing that happens in conversation, I'm paging through the book, but we're also kind of paging through the conversation. And conversations are linear, and they build on what has gone before. And they incorporate themes and motifs. They pick up things that you've talked about. And so one of the last things that we talked about in this particular conversation, after We had a nice sort of diversion into Celtic poetry and our favorite, like, Irish and Welsh writers, was the idea of God's presence, God's immanence, which is something that in our tradition we believe very clearly. And so we were talking about how in the Celtic tradition, there is this very real sense that God is present in all of the mundane aspects of our day. And so we were talking about this collection of Scottish poetry that none of you knows called the Carmina Gadelica. An anthropologist named Alexander Carmichael collected these poems in the Scottish Highlands in the 19th century. And they were poems and prayers that had been passed down in Scotland for hundreds and hundreds of years. And the prayers were prayers about banking the fire at night. God be with me as I bank the fire, as I put my children to sleep. God be with me as I light the fire in the morning. God be with me as I take the cattle out to the field. God be with me as I knead the bread. All of these incredible prayers about the most mundane, prosaic parts of our day. But what these Scottish prayers remind us is that God is present in everything. And then Rowan goes on to say that's a theme that you find in the mainstream of Christian spirituality. You find it in St. Teresa. You find it in the Benedictine tradition. It's something that Thomas Merton writes about from time to time. Although the word mindfulness has acquired a particular kind of contour these days, that's what they're writing about. In effect, St. Teresa says that in union with God, you are able to wash the dishes more effectively. You are present in your washing of the dishes. And then Rowan goes on to talk about a British writer called Philip Toynbee, who he admires very much. And how the biggest part in that writer's spiritual journey was that being present. And so he says, this writer describes feeling hungry in the middle of the night and making a sandwich. And I don't know about you, but I tend to multitask at meals a lot. If I'm not sitting down to family dinner, I'm reading the news or I'm doing something else or watching TV. I'm not paying attention to the food. And what this writer said about mindfulness, if you make a sandwich in the middle of the night, sit down and be with your sandwich. So basically what T said was, no, I am eating a sandwich. Eating. 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 And when he was digging in the garden, so I am digging, digging, digging. Because, he said, maybe that will help me when I come to the time that I am dying. 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 God is present at all times, and we know this theologically, we know it spiritually, but we don't always know it emotionally or intellectually because we have not given ourselves to that realization. We've not given ourselves to the intention, we've not made ourselves present to God's presence. And all of these things have been really valuable reminders for me of things that I knew or had read or had known from my life at some other time. And so to hear Rowan talk about these things has been a really lovely kind of spiritual gift. And these actually all come out of the very first of the seven conversations we had. Like, we could have stopped right there. That's plenty. But we went on to talk about other stuff. And so I'm going to move to the second thing, and we'll talk very quickly about our shared love of literature and culture and some of the ways that we found spiritual meaning in it. And the first thing that I want to think about, I've been thinking about a lot because Jeannie and I saw Hamilton in New York a few months ago. And, you know, it's been out for a long time. I'm not necessarily the earliest adopter of any trend. But I have not been able to stop thinking about it since I saw it. Because if you've seen it or if you know some of the music, the characters are so incredibly compelling and rich and challenging and multifaceted and complicated. Alexander Hamilton is the hero of the play, and yet there are things he does that are really bad or really stupid. And Aaron Burr is the villain of the play, but he's in many ways a sympathetic character who is in reaction to Hamilton and Hamilton's way of being in the world. And there are all of these incredible characters with incredible lives. And this is going to lead us to something in the conversation piece that we're going to end with. But one of the things that Rowan and I talked about that was really important was the idea that in literature and culture, we can understand our lives and the lives of people around us by seeing really well-drawn characters. And so he talked about the great novelists. He talked a lot about Shakespeare. He is, as I said, an aficionado of Shakespeare. And every time I go to see him, he's just come from seeing like 5 different productions and can compare them with the other 25 productions of that play that he has seen. And the thing that was really at the heart of it is what Rowan called a God's eye view of human nature. None of us ever really knows anybody except ourselves, if that. We have good views of people close to us, bad views of people distant from us or on the other side of a cultural divide from us. But what great stories remind us is that every person is, as Rowan said, the hero of his or her own play. That's a really important revelation about human nature, and particularly about the people that we find it really difficult to connect with or understand. So we'll talk more about this in the conversation piece, but this is a really essential thing. Everybody in the world has this rich life and history and brokenness and things that they yearn for. And so when I teach fiction, it's one of the things that I talk about. Rowan is so interested in the fact that I'm a fiction writer because he thinks that I have some sort of hidden knowledge because of this. What I know is that I talk to my students about 2 things. I say, you cannot write a story about somebody before you know where they're broken and what their greatest desires are. And as you think about your own life, those are essential truths. What are the things that I've had to overcome or I'm still having to overcome? And what are the things that I want, that I would give my life for? When we can understand that every human being has those things, it becomes very difficult to push them into a category where we don't see them as fully human. And that's one of the things that great literature can give us. A second thing Rowan said is that great characters teach us about our lives. And I believe that this is true as well. A lot of the writing that I do, as some of you know, is at this sort of intersection between religion and culture, where I talk about the different kinds of lessons that we can learn from great films or great stories or music. I'm working on a piece for The Atlantic Monthly on the TV show The Good Place and the moral lessons that are embedded in that. And I'm really interested in that because it was an essential part of my own spiritual journey. Some of you know that for about 20 years I was outside of any organized faith tradition. But every human being is a spiritual being. Everybody needs spiritual food. And if you're not getting it from the Eucharist, then maybe you're getting it from someplace else. I mean, that's the only way that you're going to stay healthy and stay alive. And so the awareness that we have from many of these stories grows out of our sense that we can explore ethical questions in the lives of other characters without having to make their mistakes. So when I talk about Hamilton, one night Hamilton did a really bad thing. And I can see the ramifications of that in his life and in the lives of the people who love him. And I don't have to do that thing to figure it out. I mean, I should know that. If you've seen the play, you know what I'm talking about. But there's this very real sense that what we can learn from these characters can teach us something vital about ourselves. And so one of the things that Rowan talks about is that we can watch a character's life in a story from a certain starting point to a certain ending point. And in Hollywood, that ending point is usually Z. So you start in this bad place and you end happily. And there's a theological truth to that. We believe in happy endings. We believe that no matter what may happen in this life, as evidenced by the life and death and resurrection of Jesus, that God is at work and will bring good out of this in time. But Rowan talks a lot about why we need muted endings and even unhappy endings in stories. Because sometimes that is the place where people are living. You know, they are not at Z. You know, it's not the closing happily ever after. And so if you are a person living in brokenness or living with people who are living in brokenness, it is important to have stories that don't end with all the details tied up. And so Rowan talks about Crime and Punishment. How many of you have read Crime and Punishment at some time in your life? All right, it's about this guy named Raskolnikov, and he kills someone, and much of the story is about the ramifications of that, the moral ramifications of that, the ramifications for his soul. And so what Rowan says about it, at the end, Raskolnikov has not actually turned into a nice person. He is sort of repentant, but not very. He's a work in progress. And I think Dostoevsky trusts us to say, do we trust this story to be going somewhere, rather than giving us the resolution we long for? That's a risk, and it's interesting when novelists take that risk. And so he and I talked about that, because that's the sort of ending that I've written in my novels as well. It's not the everything tied up, happy ending. The character's in a different place than where he began. And so the example that I talked about in our conversation is the Kenneth Lonergan film Manchester by the Sea. And if you've seen that film, the character played by Casey Affleck, if we say he starts at A, he doesn't end at Z, which is where we would love him to end. At the end of that story where he has been so badly broken by life, we would love to see him come out of his shell and love completely and give himself to life. And he is not there. And in the conversation I told Rowan, I interviewed Kenneth Lonergan, and he said, I don't ever write a story where people end up in the same place. But he's gone from A to D instead of A to Z. And we have to recognize that is a human story for us as well. There have been times, long periods of my life, where I was at D. And to see a story that reflected my life and my experience was soul-filling for me. So those are some things about literature and culture, particularly about story. And these actually are the kinds of things we talk about every summer when I see him. Instead of watching football, we talk for 8 hours. And it seems like it should be exhausting, but it's actually kind of exhilarating. And so, you know, I show up at his house, and we talk all afternoon, and then we go to dinner with the family and talk, and then we stay up late into the night and talk. So the last thing that I want to talk about is talking. And I'll show you a couple of things very quickly that I think sort of bear on this. If you can say goodbye to Rowan for a second. A couple of months ago, Fox News asked me to write an essay about conversation. Now, those of you that know me know that I am fairly progressive in pretty much every sense of my life, and Fox News is not my normal news source. And that is not in any way a dig at anybody who is watching Fox News. Everybody in my family watches Fox News. But when I was asked by Fox News to write something about how to have conversation across political and cultural divides, I thought, this is the Holy Spirit at work. I am absolutely going to do that. And what I talked about in the essay were basically the lessons that I got from talking with Rowan over the years and from talking with all these media sources about talking with Rowan, about having great conversations. And then the other thing that occurred to me, for the last 3 years, as some of you know, I've been convening conversations about race and reconciliation. And we've been using films about race and prejudice as a way of initiating these conversations. And so we've been doing this at Washington National Cathedral, and we've been doing it at Trinity Church Wall Street, which is actually where Alexander Hamilton and his wife are buried. And the Reverend Canon Kelly Brown Douglas has become one of my dear friends, even though we are radically different. She tells a story often about how the first time I called the National Cathedral with this idea that I felt like the cathedral needed to be doing a series of films on race and prejudice. And she just says, I thought this white guy from Texas was just crazy. Why is he calling me? What do we possibly have to talk about? And on the face of it, I mean, we are different in a whole lot of ways. Our life experience has been different. But as we have talked to each other over the last 3 years, on stage and off stage, over meals, late at night, Kelly and I have discovered as you will discover here, as we think about conversation, that we are so much more alike than we are different. I mean, that is the truth of our humanity. I believe that at my core. I believe most of you believe that as well. However different somebody may appear to us, however hateful they may seem to us, we are still so much more alike than we are different. And each of us, and you all know this theologically, but I want you to hear it emotionally, each of us is a child of God, beloved by God in the same way. God doesn't love me more because I'm more fun. God doesn't love you more because you're more responsible. God loves us all equally. Jesus died for everyone, everywhere. So, as we finish up, I want to leave you with a couple of thoughts about conversation and how it works. And these are the things that I've sort of pulled out of this experience of writing the book with Rowan and the conversations that I've been having about conversation. The first one actually grows out of the thing about great characters and the multifaceted nature of human beings. Everybody has their reasons. That is hard for us sometimes to understand. And I experienced this in my own life largely around the Thanksgiving table. This may be familiar to some of you. So you're sitting there with your liberals and your conservatives and your progressives, your atheists, your crazy Uncle Phil. And you all have shared DNA. But when it comes to what's going on in your heads, there are so many differences that it's hard to imagine that you can sit at the same table. And some Thanksgivings, it doesn't work very well, right? But in our tradition, what makes us Episcopalian, what makes us Anglican, is not that we have a certain set of beliefs or a theological screen, a certain creed that we necessarily all have to adhere to other than the historical creeds of Christianity. We gather at the table. There is a commitment to love and honor and serve each other, and we gather at the table. And so I wrote in a recent book about the Episcopal Church that when you looked at a given pew at St. David's, you might have like 8 radically different people in the same pew. It could be your family, even, and they could be radically different. But we are all gathering at the table. And this is something that's grown up for me a lot in conversations with my family as well. My grandma, my Assembly of Grandma of God grandma, who some of you have heard me talk or preach about, passed away earlier this year at the age of 99. She was never going to change her mind. Not about God, not about politics, not about the Episcopal Church. She was never going to see it as worthy. And one of the things that I had to come to was that realization. I could be angry at her, and I was. But she had reasons. Because the Assembly of God Church had rescued her, just like the Episcopal Church rescued me. And she wasn't nervous about Episcopalians because she thought that secretly we were followers of Satan. She was nervous about the Episcopalians because she did not see how anybody could be as godly, as warm, as loving as the people who had rescued her. And once I began to understand that, I could turn my anger around. Everybody has their reasons. What that leads us to do, once we start realizing that we can't demonize people for having their reasons, is we begin to stop dividing people into us and them. And there's a wonderful song by the Irish rock band U2, which simply says, "There is no them. There is only us." And once you can start believing that, you can start saying, okay, I can have conversation, and maybe it's not going to change anybody's mind. But I will tell you, the last conversation I had with my grandma before she passed, I was changed. And I could love her in a way I had not been able to love her for years. And that's one of the things that's really important about conversation. Because as we're going to see, so much of conversation these days is about changing somebody else's mind. When really, the only person's mind who we can change is our own. So, second thing. Everyone has their reasons is the first thing. We are more alike than we are different is something that I mentioned to you a second ago. So my conversations with Kelly Brown Douglas. I went from being the crazy white guy from Texas to being a dear friend. We are more alike than we are different. And when we are willing to listen and to understand what people's reasons are. This is something that's been really helpful to me with my mom. I have asked my mom why she believes what she believes, which I think is one of the essential questions to ask in conversation. Why? Why do you think that? Not judgmentally. I just want to understand. Why? And so we have very different political beliefs, but she's explained to me why she voted for the person she voted for. And it makes sense to me, not in my own life, but in her life. I can see why she did what she did. We are more alike than we are different. They were driven by values very similar to my own values, even though we came to very different conclusions. So here's the last thing, and this is what I want to leave with. Conversation is not about conversion. If you watch talk shows, if you see confrontations in the street, if you look at the Thanksgiving table, you will notice that most of the time people are talking past each other. You know, I cannot turn on a talk show, like a news show where they've got eight people, because it just sort of seems like they're all talking at each other. And one of my favorite examples of this from literature and culture is from Spike Lee's movie Do the Right Thing, which is a movie where almost nobody listens to each other. They are all talking at each other or shouting at each other. When I showed this at an Episcopal parish in Delaware, an elderly black woman said, "Nobody is listening." And that was precisely it. Nobody was listening. Everybody felt very strongly. Everybody had their reasons for what they believed. And nobody was listening. So what I think about when I think about these conversations with Rowan, you know, I mentioned to you that he is the most brilliant person that I know. When I read one of his books, I have to stop about every page because I discover that I have underlined everything, which is, as you know, as useless as underlining nothing. And so Rowan could have filled every one of our seven conversations with brilliance. But what made them conversations was that he asked me questions and he listened to what I had to say and wondered. And at the end of the book, there are a couple of things that he mentions. In his afterword to the book, he said, "One of the things that reviewing these conversations reminds me is how over and over again I have this thought, I didn't realize I knew that until we talked about it." So one of the things that's really important is that an actual conversation, it is a learning process for both sides. And theologically as well as actually, what Rowan would say is that we need each other and conversation with each other to grow and thrive and to understand. But the last thing, and I'm going to read this to you in its entirety before we finish up, and then we'll close. England is also, as you probably know, extremely polarized right now. It is very difficult for people to talk to each other across these great divides. But here's what he says at the very end of the book. He says, "We know that the last word does not belong to the merchants of zero-sum games, to those who talk for victory and for the humiliation and silencing of the other. When that happens, as it does so much in our increasingly insane political world, we can be sure that people have turned their backs on any hope of a shared world. And this, in turn, means that they have turned their backs on the idea that there is a truth and a hope more solid than anything an individual ego can sustain. The world shrinks to the scale of my own experience and conviction and drive for power. We desperately need cultures and institutions of shared meaning that allow space for patient talking and listening, because they let us see something of a horizon that is not just yours or mine. For us as Christians, it is quite simply the space into which the mystery of God invites us. The sacred space that isn't anyone's property, but is somewhere where unlikely people can find a home together." Let's close with prayer. Thank you so much for being here this morning. Holy One, help us to walk into that space, to be present to your presence, to listen. Walk with us this week as we strive to do better, to be better, Help us to understand that that intention should be at the heart of all we profess. In the name of your Son, who lives and reigns with you in the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.